Welcome to the Native Habitat Podcast. If you've even got the slightest interest in the outdoors, you're in the right place. We're your hosts, Kyle Leiberger
and Jake Brown. Get ready to hit the field with folks like us who have a passion for wildlife, plants, and native habitat.
Speaking of native habitat, Jake, I think we've got a little bit of an ecosystem going on in here right now.
All the wasp and I guess it's the time of year for the ladybugs because there's a million of them.
Yeah, we got us a bunch of them swarming the windows. But, we'll get to that later on. We'll talk a little bit about the beetle barn. But, Jake, I guess everybody listening in probably knows who I am from being on so many videos in the Native Habitat Project. But where are you from and what's your background?
Yeah, I grew up in East Central Alabama on a farm. Family did a little bit of everything: commercial poultry, cattle, row cropping, horticulture. But yeah, I just grew up with a love of the outdoors, and my earliest memories were flipping rocks, looking for crawfish and what are those little aquatic salamanders called?
Mud puppies.
And mud puppies. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Just caught them too. But now we're neighbors, so.
Yeah, just down the road.
Moved up to North Alabama, so.
Yeah, I met my wife at Auburn. I got a degree in civil engineering with an environmental emphasis. And she's a computer engineer, so when we were talking about places to move up here in the Huntsville area, in Silicon Holler, as they call it, there's tons of jobs for, you know, aerospace, mechanical, obviously software and computer engineers, so it was a pretty easy choice. Civil engineers could find jobs, you know, pretty well all over the state, so it made a lot of sense for us to move back here to her hometown.
Jake's bringing me out of the stone age over here, so I don't even know how to plug in any of this stuff, so.
Well, I'm faking it till I make it.
Jake just quit his job a couple weeks ago, last week.
Yeah, a little bit of a career detour is what I've been calling it. It was a lot of fun telling the boomer generation that I worked with that I was leaving to be a podcaster. They thought I was joking at first, which I mean that's an oversimplification, but that's a big part of it. So they've been having a lot of fun giving me a hard time about that. So
yeah, so I'm trying to step it up. We've been making 1 minute videos on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook for almost a year. I guess a year this week. I started making videos last year, and I got to step my game up, and we're going to go into a little more detail on certain topics, and I think the best way to do that is through podcasts. So that's where this was born, and Jake's here to help me, and he can help me on consults with his background in civil engineering and drawing up plans and things like that. So we'll be doing a bunch of consults. We were doing some last week already, but I guess that'll be part of it, and making videos and educational content about native plants and native ecosystems, and keep doing what we've been doing with the Native Habitat Project, just trying to get people to appreciate what's around them. And then now we got a podcast, so we can go dive a little deeper into certain topics on and have different experts on about different things. But we had a— what was your favorite consult last week, Jake?
We had some bangers.
We had what? At least
four?
Four, yeah.
Lots of limestone. What, you know, historically would have been limestone savannas, limestone
glades.
And I mean, just really cool properties in southeast central or south central Tennessee mostly. We do any in Alabama?
Yeah, we did some in North Alabama. Flat Rock.
Flat Rock, yeah.
Flat Rock. And then I guess that was this week. We looked at a place in Priceville.
Yeah, that's right.
But that Mark's place in Prospect, he's got 180 acres there, and 80 acres of it is NRCS planted some, or I think Quail Forever helped out, and they planted some native horses and grass fields, and that was back in 2017, and they have never been burned. Some of them are pretty rank.
Yeah.
then we did a little fire on 40 acres of it this year, and we'll leave it at this. It was wild.
Yeah.
It was a wild day. Jake wasn't there. I think he's probably glad he wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't want any part of that.
It was the most exciting fire I've had burning grasslands.
Well, there's plenty of fuel there.
Yeah, that's the reason. And then wind switched up on us during the day, but
it's bound to happen at some point. You guys had a backup fire breaks in place, and if it weren't for that, it would have been the next thing to start burning would have been another how many acres?
Yeah, that neighbor looked like he had like 100 acres of warm season grasses.
Yeah, and once that got started, there was no stopping that.
Yeah, luckily there's a few creeks and some fire breaks in between us and them, so
yeah,
it never got on across the line. But yeah, he also has 100 acres of timber, and I'd say probably 40 or 50 of that is glades.
Yeah,
a lot of mature cedars in there because of the lack of fire. There hadn't been fire in there in probably decades, and allowed that cedar to get up and close off the canopy. And those cedars, they don't lose their leaves, so they're shading everything out year round. And so he had a big tornado come through there. Not a big one. I think it was an F1 or F2 or something, but came through there and blew down all his cedar trees, or not all of them, but probably half of them.
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah.
He's wanting us to come in and clean that up. I've got some loggers working in the area, so they're going to come in there and remove some of that blow down and do a salvage operation, salvage that timber that's on the ground. And then we might remove some of the overstory as well. And there's some that had some tops blow out and things like that. But
when something like that happens, storm comes through, I know that initially they were pretty bummed out about it, but that probably could have been one of the best things that could have happened for them. There's a lot of bare dirt under that. I mean, those things have just turned the understory into a desert. But
yeah, the owner is a quail hunter too. He's a big time into quail.
Yeah,
and so when I showed up, he was really really bummed out about it. But quickly I saw all the limestone there and it looked like a glade. And then I remembered that Dwayne Estes with Southeastern Grassland Initiative had sent me a pin of some rare plants in that area of Tennessee. And I was looking through them. One of those pins was right on this guy's property line. So Dwayne Estes was riding down the road and seen this limestone outcrop and pulled over and found some marble seed. And I think there's some necklace.
Glade crest.
So there's some rare plants there, and this was in the power line strip and on the edge of the road. So everything else was shaded out in cedars. So when it blew down, I was telling him, I was like, man, this is the best thing that could have happened.
Yeah,
to this
especially
place.
For a quail hunter. I mean, really.
Yeah, and he's got
any kind of wildlife.
He's got a bunch of chinkapin oaks. And so we're gonna clean it up. Probably cut some more cedars, even the ones that are standing and healthy, just to bring in more sunlight. We're gonna leave the chinkapin oaks and hickories and things like that. Turn it back into a savanna and glade, and that's gonna tie into his warm season grass fields he's already got. That we're gonna do some work on those as well. Hopefully, over the years, introduce some more wildflower seeds.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of becomes a problem when you have too many native warm season grasses, and even for quail.
But, yeah. There's not they. You got to have the grasses for the structure for nesting and everything, but I feel like the forbs and the legumes, the wildflowers are a little too overlooked sometimes. Yeah. People are going for that grassy savanna look when the wildflowers and those things that produce seed and then attract pollinators for the poults to forage on. You know, that's one thing that's overlooked. I mean, since they had not burned that property since it was planted, is that correct?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's been 5 years.
It was just the areas that have not been burned to this day. You know, you guys didn't burn his entire property.
No,
we burned half of it. Yeah, I mean, the areas that still have not been burned, there's no telling what kind of tonnage is there. It is
a lot.
It is rank. But there's really not that much for quail.
No,
there right the, now in those areas.
Seeds, that's what their food source is. And then all the insects that are attracted from those wildflowers, that's another food source.
Yeah.
So bringing in some diversity, that's the biggest thing with every ecosystem, is you want to maintain biodiversity and make sure those places become diverse and there's not too much of one species. And so that's kind of what happened in there. There's there's a lot of blue stem, big blue stem, Indian grass,
switchgrass. Yeah.
And there was, you know, on the edges, there was some wild rye. I bet you there might even be some gamma grass out there.
Yeah.
We'll probably see this year, but.
Yeah. The way his property is laid out, the edge that borders the highway where they access the property, it's kind of at a higher elevation, and then it drops off into the bottom where all those warm season grass plantings were. Mm-hmm. And then on the opposite side and the other corner of the property, it's another high area, and both those high areas are where those glades are. I'm really looking forward, once those things are thinned out and they see a few fires, just the view of that entire farm from those high points, it's really going to open stuff up. It's going to be a whole different property once all that's done.
It's going to be real good for quail.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting to watch. So this is in the Nashville Basin. This is the physiographic region for this area. And so if you're in the Nashville Basin, there's a really good iNaturalist project that, and I think there's a seed list too by Southeastern Grassland Initiative. I think they have a seed list for plants of the Nashville Basin. So if you're in that area, you can look at that and see what plants you should have in your grasslands. But let's talk about the beetle barn, Jake. What do you think about it?
Man, you were telling me about it before I got to see it, and it exceeded expectations for sure. You words didn't quite match the grandeur. I mean, it's
luxurious.
So, yeah, it's luxurious for sure. Yeah, anybody who's watching the video podcast will get a little glimpse of it. At some point, we need to do an MTV Cribs style tour of it. But
So the beetle barn, it's called the beetle barn because in college I had domestic beetles in here, and I was cleaning skulls with those beetles and
cedar post skull works.
Yeah, cedar post skull works. There's still a sign up in here, but deer skulls, I'd clean all kinds of stuff, bobcats, turkeys.
Yeah.
I did a paddlefish for Chris Keenum. And,
oh, yeah, I saw that. The bills of those things are.
That wasn't mine because I told him to use that peroxide.
Oh, no.
And it, melted the entire paddlefish skull. I felt okay. So bad.
Well, so, he does have one.
Yeah, he went back and got another one, I think.
But, from a different service.
Yeah.
He went somewhere other than Cedar Post.
But.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've never looked up what the skeletal system of the bill of one of those paddlefish looks like, mm-hmm. it'd be worth a Google. Those things are
incredible.
Crazy looking. I don't know how to describe it. It's
and
just
I think
like
the only way you could clean those things is with those beetles.
But yeah, that's worth a look if you've never seen it.
We had all kinds of stuff in here, alligators and bears, and cleaned a lot of skulls. And then I got married, and I wasn't able to come over here every night. This beetle barn is at the place I grew up at. So when I got married, I was about 10, 15 minutes away, but couldn't get over here as often. So that kind of was an end to the beetle business. And then, but when I was a kid, this is our hay barn. Actually, it was our neighbor's tool shed. And then they moved off and my dad drug it over here because they gave it to him. And we stored hay in here. So it went from a hay barn, a feed barn, to a beetle barn, and now we're making podcasts in here.
Yeah,
so pretty nice. Just this wood paneling. It's a nice place, infested with all sorts of stuff. We're probably gonna find a lot of different insects in here.
That'd just give us an opportunity. We won't have to go out in the field.
We just be in the middle of a podcast. Oh, look, what is this crawling across the
field? Yeah, I'm looking forward to having the different guests, the different specialists, from entomologists, obviously, you know, botanist and things like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different people who are interested into like certain narrow topics that are areas of wildlife and fisheries and things like that.
Yeah,
and those are like snails and things like that. That's something I don't know much about. Mussels, that'd be a cool one.
Absolutely,
crayfish and things like that. Hoping to have some of those kind of folks on, and then just open our goal, I guess, overall is to open people's eyes to what's around you, because it's hard to appreciate something if you don't know about it. So that's kind of our goal with this podcast. And hopefully we can get Kevin England on to begin with. He's the botanist I've known for a while. He's the one who really launched me into native plants and being interested in them. So you met him yesterday. What'd you think, Jake? Did I talk him up too much?
He lived up to the hype when he starts giving the scientific names of all this stuff. Man, he loses me immediately. Yeah. But he's a really... really nice, laid-back guy.
Each thing. He knows the names of every part of every plant.
Yeah.
What to look for to identify each one, and it's incredible. you quickly realize you're a novice when you're
yeah.
in the presence of Kevin England. So
yeah.
He really knows his plant stuff. So
yeah.
But hopefully we can have him on here. And then I'm hoping to have Jessica Thompson on too. She's a native plant landscaper. She was from Atlanta. She lives in Alabama now. She has a native plant nursery. She started hers the year after I started mine, which mine is taking a break this year, but her native plant nursery is Recreative Natives, and she does a great job laying out landscaping with native plants. That's something I'm not even good at. Is I know the native plants, but putting things where they'll look good, that's a totally different.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really important, you know, because my wife in particular, we've been in the middle of remodeling our house, and we're kind of to the landscaping stage, and I really want us to go with the natives for everything that we put out there, and she's on board with it, but she's a visual person. She needs to see, before we spend a bunch of money to landscape our yard, she needs to see what it's going to look like, and she needs to know, you know, hey, this is the look I was going for. What are some native alternatives that are going to play the role of these non-natives that could be problematic? You know, she's willing to do it, and I think a lot of people will be given some examples, some options, and I think that's going to be really important for getting more converts to.
I can appreciate that native plants look like they're from the wild. I like that. I want to bring like a wild ecosystem to my yard and to my landscaping, because to me that's like, I love that stuff.
Yeah,
I love being outdoors, and I love for things to have a wild look. But to get everybody interested in native landscaping, it's going to take making it look good.
Yeah, I would say almost all of the native wildflower and grass gardens I've ever seen have been what most people would view as unkept, you know. Not it looks a little more weedy by definition. A lot of these are weeds in most people's idea. They're unwanted.
The non-natives that are
absolutely
that are in there right now.
Hopefully there can be a cultural shift, and I think with the Native Habitat Project and a lot of others like you, I think that there is view change for a lot of people. They're starting to see, you know, hey, these Bradford pears, we've caused some problems by throwing these things up everywhere. What is it? The last third of March, it's the 21st, I think. This is a really good time of year to be driving around if you want to get a gauge of the scale of how problematic these things are. They are so invasive, and they're such aggressive propagators. I mean, they just, I don't know, is it birds?
Birds will move the seeds. Like across the road here, we got a radio tower, I guess or a cell phone tower, and it has wires coming down the sides. Well,
it's a perfect place for them to.
It's surrounded by Bradford pears, just with those birds laying on the wires. But you're going to get me on a tangent,
and
you're going
to
ruin my.
Yeah, sorry. I asked him to come up with an outline, because we're both bad about getting off topic, and I don't know if we followed the first couple of bullet points at least. Yeah. So where are we at now?
Well, I was going to say I can't even get my own mom to plant natives. In her landscaping, like 100% native. So when she moved up to her place, she brought lamb's ear with her, which, you know, I bought my parents' place, so I killed it all here. But she brought some with her up there. That stuff's spreading everywhere. And she's out of town next week, so I told her, I said, I'm going to go over to your house and do some weeding. I'm going to do some weeding for your flower beds.
Did she know what you meant when you said weeding?
Oh, she knew. Yeah. She knew.
Yeah.
Because I give her a hard time about it. I'm understanding with, you know, the average person, but my mom, I give her a hard time about it. All right, y'all, we're excited to tell y'all about this week's sponsor for the podcast, and this is a company that we've had experience with for the past several years, and it's a great company. We're talking about Roundstone Native Seeds, and this is a company that's been growing and supplying high-quality, regionally adapted native seeds to the eastern half of the U.S. for over 25 years. And these guys are farmers and conservationists just like us that have grown from a small family-owned business to one of the largest seed providers in the East. And I can say from experience that you're not going to find a staff that's more friendly and knowledgeable than the staff at Roundstone Native Seeds. Plus, they have really high-quality, clean seed, and they've developed different ecotypes adapted to each region that they serve. And let me tell you, the reason they focus on quality and service is because every success that they bring to their customers is a living demonstration and incentive for others to use natives. Y'all go check out our friends at Roundstone Native Seeds. So yeah, the question I get the most on TikTok and Instagram, Facebook, and in my emails is, how do I know what's native to my area? And that seems to be a really popular question. And I had the same problem when I was getting into native plants, sort of. I think what helped me though is that I was already out in the field, and that's how I was learning what's native.
Yeah,
is I was able to see native ecosystems in my area, so I was seeing which plants were there. Nowadays, you can use iNaturalist and identify plants. So just start looking for anything that's flowering and use iNaturalist, take a picture of it, and look. First thing you do is look to see if it's native or if it's non-native. You know, if it's native, start learning about it, and it might be a plant that's good for your landscaping. Yeah. But yeah, iNaturalist is a really good tool. Have you used it much?
Yes. When I started off, before I started following your stuff, I think I was using, what is it called? The Picture This app.
Yeah, a lot of people use that.
Yeah, and it was really helpful. But yeah, iNaturalist, man. And I love getting on there and looking at the observations in there. You know, you could pull up a map and just sort it by, you know, whether you're looking for reptiles, amphibians, fungus.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you can look, narrow it down to plants. If you're looking for something, like I was looking for a strawberry bush for deer. I was going to do some shrub plantings of strawberry bush on our place. But I'm kind of like you. Anything that I plant on our farm, I want it to be, at the very least, from the same watershed. You know, something that would definitely have occurred there before Europeans. And so that's, I hopped on there and I was able to look on the river just a few miles upstream and see that somebody had
seen,
yeah. And I mean, there's pictures and everything. And I was like, well, I know sometimes depending on how rare something is, you might want to protect it and kind of hide where you found it. But in that particular case, it's really easy to hop in the river, go to that point, get some cuttings off of it and propagate it. So
this is not a promotion for going out and digging. Do not look for plants and then go out and dig them. I've watched entire populations of plants disappear because people knew they were there and they would go dig them and they'd be like, oh, it's okay for me to just take one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're down to one.
40 people do that.
Gone.
Yeah.
I've seen the entire populations disappear from 100 plants to none.
Yeah.
Because of that. So you gotta be ethical about it. I collect seeds, and even collecting seeds, you need to be ethical. So you leave some and you take some. I usually take no more than 10%. Of what's there. But yeah, iNaturalist, man, it's a great tool. You can explore on there. You can find projects in your area. So for like right here, we're in the Molten Valley. There's projects called Savannas of the Molten Valley, Limestone Barrens of the Molten Valley. And you can get on there and you can look through those plants that should exist in those areas. But yeah, if you get on there and post plants too, they're using it for science. And if it's a rare plant, you can obscure where you saw it, so people aren't going to be able to go back and find that exact population. And that's a good thing to do, because you don't want to put rare plants on there and give their exact locations. But there's a lot of common plants. That's going to be a rare case to find rare plants.
Yeah. Yeah, talking about knowing the difference between a native and non-native plant, I grew up in the springtime thinking – all those, I always called them jonquils, but I think they're those like yellow daffodils. That's like one of the first things that's really obvious that comes up in the spring. So I just, you know, those were beautiful to me, and that was an indication that turkey season was there. It was, you know, it was always exciting to see those pop up. Wisteria is another example of something that's like, oh, this is beautiful. I love
American
this.
Wisteria, but
oh, do we?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. There's a native one, but you got to be able to tell them apart. Most of the wisteria you see probably is native.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Well, you got to show me that native stuff. Yeah. Most of the time, it's usually on an old home place.
Yeah.
So I would assume it in the same areas that you see those daffodils
If it's misbehaving, it's probably the non-native.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's usually, it's not quite as aggressive as kudzu, but it's usually covering up, you know, some sort of structure or a, you know, killing a tree that it's attached to. So,
but that's a good transition there, Jake. You were talking about hunting, and I think that's both of us. I think that's how both of us got into native plants and managing ecosystems, and it all started with me with deer hunting and how to make habitat better for deer, which now is like, man, it's like the easiest animal to manage for.
You
give them a bunch of vegetation at their level and a good diversity of browse, they're gonna be just fine.
They're generalist. I mean, they can make it happen as long as they've got the green.
Yeah, but those specialists like quail, that's when I really started getting in and diving into different species and grasslands and stuff like that. But you kind of had the same
path. Yeah, so I've always just loved wildlife in general. My dad, he was always into small game hunting, and my brother, I was pretty young, he got me into deer hunting, took me kill my first deer.
They're spotlighting.
Yeah, well,
South Alabama.
Yeah, it is a cultural thing down there. There's no doubt about that. But no, it was legally taken. But
not all Alabama folks are like that. So
yeah, there are some. There are reasons that stereotypes exist. Yeah, there are. Yeah,
I bought my Suzuki Samurai. I bought it. It was painted camo.
Yeah,
and I joked with Anna when we went to pick it up. I said that thing's going to have some spotlights in it, and it had three of them.
Three Q-beams,
three of them in it. And so, I was joking, but no, they had. Really
It was the poaching rig. Yeah. Well, it is funny, but it's not. Man, it's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
For reasons other than just conservation. I mean, it's, firing rifles off at night. You never know when somebody's camping up on the hillside or something behind it. But anyway, yeah. So I guess about 10 years ago, one of the family farms, we had about 80% of the timber that was cut on that place. Nobody told me that was going to happen. I just showed up one day and the timber was cut. And I just, at the time, I was thinking, well, there goes all the deer hunting. You know, that was ignorant of me to have that view of it. But I was really bummed out about it at the time. But we've always had a covey of quail that hung out down there. You'd see them about once or twice in a deer season. And I said, well, at the very least, I could start managing for quail. So I'd always burned, since I was probably, 16 or so. And at the time, it was kind of misled. And I knew that when you burned, it was good for wildlife. But I didn't really have a handle on why. Anyway, I started, after the timber was cut on my family's farm, I started managing for quail. And I started noticing a lot more forbs and legumes coming back. And we've always had about, for the last, 10, 15 years, we've always had about 20 acres of soybeans planted down there. And I just, it kind of had everything that the Outdoor Channel or Pursuit Channel would tell you that deer need to get big. I always had mineral licks and, those soybeans. I had fall food plots that were really, really well established. Anyway, I noticed after I started managing for quail, there was a big response in quail. I mean, the number of quail really, I don't know if exploded is the right word, but it went from seeing one covey occasionally to when you're down there, especially in the summer and spring. I mean, you're hearing the males calling all the time. You're seeing just little chicks running all over the place. There's a decent population. We've even taken a dog down there and had luck, getting on birds, so it made a difference. But what I didn't expect is the difference that it made with the deer. Every year prior to that, especially prior to the timber being cut, there would be a really obvious browse line, tons of browse in there. Well, I noticed that those soybeans were getting browsed on less and less. And I was walking around, I noticed that all these little, a lot of desmodium, partridge pea, all this stuff was being nipped off, especially on the roadsides and trails and everything like that. Well, what I'd done managing for quail was just create, a salad bar for the deer. And I'd probably been really intensively managing with fire for the last 6 years or so. In the last 3 years is when I have noticed the biggest jump in the body size, the antler size, and the population. It can support more deer throughout the year And it's obviously there's something happening there, and in the common denominator, the thing that has changed on the property has been the intensive fire. Oh. So, well, what was
fire,
that?
Fire and timber.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the timber. I mean, it was closed canny. I was burning those pines, and the pine hardwood mixes before that, but it was closed canopy. Yeah.
But
so
that closed canopy and deer over browsing, that's a big issue.
Yeah.
There's a lot of native plants, even rare plants.
Yeah.
And if you want to decrease the diversity on your property, have a closed canopy forest and have too many deer on your property to the point that they're over browsing everything. And
yeah,
the bad thing is they over browse your native plants first, and they leave your privet and your non-natives because they don't like that stuff. That's
yeah,
not what they're
yeah,
used to having around. So
if they're browsing on privet, it's because yeah, they don't have anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, this isn't an ad to tell you go cut all your timber. Like don't do a clear cut because of this. And that's one thing we're going to probably talk about a lot in this podcast yeah, is don't listen to this podcast and listen to one thing and say, that's what I need to do with my
yeah,
property, because it depends on what your property looks like. Because if you have a property, say it's one that has like a bunch of diversity of trees. You got like chinkapins, and you have, what if you had like smoke tree and yellowwood, and like just a bunch of really rare tree species. I would never recommend you
yeah,
go in there and clear cut it. Maybe remove some undesirables. That'd probably be something you could do. But learn your property before you make any management decisions, especially like one that's that big.
And yeah,
one that would take, generations to put back to normal. But it all depends on your property. I don't want to be that person that makes a
blanket statement.
Yeah, blanket statement. Like, fire's bad. We've mm-hmm, seen what happened to that. Everybody thinks fire's bad. And
yeah, absolutely.
People stop burning, or herbicide's bad. Well, then people stop spraying. They'll let their whole entire property get taken over in English ivy because they think
yeah,
herbicides are bad, which, there's herbicides are bad in some cases, but if they're used correctly and you're using them on invasives, I've witnessed it. I've witnessed spraying invasives and watching biodiversity return
yeah,
just a really diverse amount of, or a really large diverse plant community coming back because you removed that invasive that was shading it out.
And that's without planting anything.
Yeah,
yeah,
without planting anything.
Yeah.
It's coming back from the seed bank. So
yeah,
you can do it with herbicides, so don't be afraid of those. So, but yeah, that was my point was just I don't want to make any blanket statements. But I think people probably get the point now. Like this is the stuff that we were both interested in that got us into native plants and really just learning our properties and places
yeah,
we hunted. And well, I guess that's about all I was planning for the first podcast.
All right.
You think that's good?
I think that's a wrap.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Have a good one, everybody.
Yeah. We'll see y'all next time.